March 24, 2015.
You think the Attorney General has a responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper, for example, by saying, well, he appoints somebody who's going to execute his views. What's wrong with that? Should the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General say no?
Senator, I believe that the Attorney General or the Deputy Attorney General has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president.
January 30th, 2017.
President Trump has fired acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates of Georgia, and he's named Dana Bente, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, as acting Attorney General in her place. Yates today had refused to defend the administration's recent executive order on immigration.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is Tuesday, January 31st, 2017, 5:10 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day as well. Lots to cover later in the program. We'll be talking with Edelman Public Relations about their new crisis report, government trust in government agencies, businesses. How do we trust all of these various institutions? Their annual report is out. And coming up in just a moment, we'll have the author of a new book about a famous war correspondent and photographer. That'll be just after we check the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures and all of the stock futures in the U.S. are off this morning, as a matter of fact, as the market prepares for further losses as the Trump travel ban reverberates around the world and in the country. You heard in the opening montage there the firing of the Deputy Attorney General of the United States by Donald Trump. That was the Attorney General at her confirmation hearing about a year ago, ironically being questioned by the man who is in line to be the Attorney General of the United States. Lots going on in Washington. We'll keep you posted on that in news coming up. But generally, when stuff like this happens, it doesn't end very well. There's a lot of consternation going on. One of the other times in American history when an attorney general, somebody like this, was fired was obviously during the Nixon administration. And if you're old enough to remember that, you know it was called the Saturday Night Massacre, obviously for different reasons, but people are certainly mentioning that today. Around the globe this morning, we're seeing stock prices climb again in Europe after a rough day yesterday. The FTSE, the DAX, the CAC all are a little bit higher this morning. Markets still recovering from holidays in Asia this morning, but again, Dow futures are off about 30 points. Here's some news. While you slept on Wall Street yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrials fell about 123 points. The S&P and NASDAQ also dropped. The NASDAQ fell about 47 points after closing at an all-time high on Friday. Japan's benchmark Nikkei dipped about 1.5% as a stronger yen also helped send shares lower. Today, we expect to see the Fed open its two-day meeting on interest rate policies. Among the economic reports due out today, we're going to see the Case-Shiller Home Index. Also, Consumer Confidence Index is coming for January. Japan's central bank has ended its first board meeting of the year with a decision to keep its lax monetary policy and negative benchmark interest rate unchanged. The Bank of Japan upgraded its forecast for growth, though, citing signs the world's third biggest economy is gaining momentum despite recent weakness in consumption and investment. Business leaders, CEOs of some of the world's biggest companies are fighting back against President Trump and his temporary immigration ban. The heads of Apple, Ford, and Goldman Sachs say they don't support the executive order the president signed last week, which bans refugees from Syria indefinitely and immigrants from seven Muslim countries, majority countries, from entering the U.S. Google says it's donating cash to organizations that support immigrants. Other companies say they will help employees affected by the ban, or in the case of Starbucks, hire refugees. Starbucks, as you may know, has already been hiring U.S. veterans, about 10,000 of them. The company says it will hire an equal number of refugees. Businesses already have complicated relationships with Trump, who has been openly critical of companies. Behind the scenes, many who have not spoken out yet say they are afraid of Donald Trump and the power of his 140-character Twitter account. We'll see how that plays out today. We'll keep you posted on your money as we move through the morning here on The Opening Bell and on 720 WGN. The book is called Dickie Chappelle, Under Fire, Photographs from the First American Female War Correspondent Killed in Action. John Garofalo is the author. He's with us this morning here on The Opening Bell. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning, Steve. I'm great. Thank you. And how about yourself?
I'm doing well, thank you. This is a wonderful book. Lots of photographs by Dickie Chappelle as well. Why did you decide to write this book? Why now?
Well, I think that Dickie is a great story. And what I've always felt is that she's so little known and really has a remarkable life, a great story. And she really has over time become kind of a historical footnote. And so we've got just past the 50th anniversary of her death last year. And so the timing seemed to be right with that anniversary in order to try and bring some more attention to her life and her story.
You are, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're from Wisconsin, right? And so was Dickie.
Well, actually, Dickie was from Wisconsin, but I was from Chicago originally.
Okay.
So, actually, when I was a kid, I grew up listening to WGN. So
wonderful.
So this is a great, great nostalgia for me. So thank you.
Well, it's, you know, the this is kind of familiar, I guess, is what the point I'm getting to people who live in this area, because they probably know that she's from Wisconsin or was from Wisconsin. So there's sort of a local part of this story as well. But this is a bigger story about how back then in 1965, a woman rose to war correspondent.
Yes, and what's really more remarkable, actually, that in 1965, that was sort of, unfortunately, the end of the line for Dickie Chappelle as a war correspondent. But she really started reporting on wars during World War II, so she had quite an extensive career as a war correspondent. So I would say probably longer, certainly at that time, than any other woman that had been in the war reporting game. So I think it's a significant story and something that, even today, you don't see too many women war correspondents that are out there, and there certainly are some ones that are very noteworthy. But at least at this point, Dickie Chappelle's life really was something amazing. She reported on the war, the battles of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, which were two of the bloodiest battles during World War II, and kind of continued that as long as she was able to.
The photographs and stories that she covered, many people probably know them if they see them, right?
Yes, there were certainly a couple of surprises, I think, when I was doing some research on the book, for the book, and that is that she had covered the Cuban Revolution, and which was something that was fairly well known because she had covered the Cuban Revolution and her stories appeared in Reader's Digest. But looking through some of the photos that didn't actually make it into print, to me, were much more interesting. The kinds of things that showed Fidel Castro in his command post out in Cuba with his very close circle of advisors, which included his brother Raul and actually people that he was very, very closely associated with. But here, his Fidel Castro leading a revolution, which was pretty significant. There was a life or death struggle, whether you agree with his politics later on or not. But here he is in a hammock, sort of stretching out, drinking tea, and wearing his glasses, which you really saw him pictured in glasses until he was a much older man.
What are some of the other photographs that might be the iconic ones that jumped out at you?
Well, there's one photo in particular which was released in 1945, and it was released under the title of The Dying Marine. And it's something that's a very dramatic photo of a Marine who was taken to the decks of a hospital ship that she had been on. And so you can see distress all over his face, and you can also see a giant swatch of blood across his midsection where he was shot. And for me, what was always interesting about that photo is if you take a look at it, it's very, very dramatic. But also sitting in his pocket is his toothbrush. So here you have this sort of really ordinary object of everyday life in the middle of this sort of dramatic photo on the decks of a hospital ship that's, you know, reeking of all of these unfortunate incidents with sailors and Marines that had been horribly wounded.
We should tell our audience, John, that you're a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom. Thank you for your service, by the way, and a commander in the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve as well. So you have military experience. And that goes to my next question. Why is it important that we have reporters and correspondents covering wars like Dickie did?
You know, what's interesting is that when I was there for a very short time, I was assigned as being a public affairs officer. So I was actually escorting some members of the media into southern Iraq. And it was interesting because what I kept on thinking about, since I'd already known about Chappelle's story there, is that I felt I'm looking at the new generation of Dickie Chappelle's, which to me was interesting from that standpoint. But the other part of it, to get to your question, is that essentially war is one of those things that is probably among the most unfortunate of human endeavors. It brings out the best in us. It brings out the worst in us. And I think that because today in particular, there are so few people that actually have the opportunity to have direct experience in serving in the military, serving in war zones, and being in direct combat, that we need to know what war looks like in all of its forms, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think that's what reporters do. They give us that opportunity for a glimpse at something that not everybody sees, and arguably we probably shouldn't see, and perhaps at some point maybe we'll see enough of war to at least through pictures and images that are taken by reporters to understand that it's something we shouldn't be doing unless it's absolutely necessary.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, jitters over the U.S. travel ban had investors in retreat yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 123 points to 19,971. The S&P 500 lost 14 points. The NASDAQ Composite dropped 47. The CEOs of some of the world's biggest companies are pushing back against President Trump's temporary immigration ban. The heads of Apple, Ford Motor Company, and Goldman Sachs have expressed opposition. Google is donating money to groups that support immigrants. Walmart is replacing a program that offered free shipping but had an annual fee with one that has a lower free shipping threshold and faster delivery. Walmart is hoping to answer Amazon's popular Prime membership success. The number of people traveling to Hawaii approached 9 million last year as visitor spending and arrival figures hit records for the fifth consecutive year. The Hawaii Tourism Authority says tourists spent $15.6 billion on the islands in 2016. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We're on this morning with author John Garofalo, who's written Dickie Chappelle Under Fire, photographs by the first American female war correspondent killed in action. John, how has this all changed since Dickie was on the job and in war? Are reporters still allowed to do the kinds of things that she did?
Well, things have changed, and probably in some respects. It's changed because of the fact that the nature of war has changed, and of course, you've seen stories about the fact that there's no definable battlefield anymore. And so really, you know, anytime you're out in an area that there's fighting going on, there's not necessarily a guarantee that if you're in the rear, so to speak, that you're going to be safe from any kind of action. And so I think that's become a little bit more problematic because it certainly has extended the risk factor that's out there. And plus, I also think that at the time that that Dickie was doing her reporting from World War II through Vietnam, and probably even in the years before that, that reporters were certainly always at risk and were killed while they were covering wars, but usually it was incidental to combat operations. And I think that now what's happened is that that reporters are generally more targeted directly than they probably have been in the past.
The trail she blazed, I guess, would be the way to describe it. In reading your book, I mean, she was often referred to as that broad, and she had to fight her way through to get into combat. What is the trail she's blazed for women today?
Well, certainly, I think that because of the fact that she was somebody that was willing to go into wars at the very, very beginning, she went out of her way to go as far forward as she possibly could. She also had realized that it was important for her to be as fit as possible. She didn't want to be a drag on any of the troops that were out there. She didn't want anybody to get killed because of her being there. And so that was something she was very, very mindful of. And so from that standpoint, I think that what I see nowadays, I probably see more in the nature of Dickie Chappelle-like reporters, female reporters that are reporting on wars right now. And actually, I have to tell you that that the foreword of the book was written by a woman named Jackie Spinner, who is a Washington Post war correspondent that spent a lot of time covering wars in the Middle East. And it was a beautiful foreword. I have to tell you, she did a great job. And she also, I think, typifies that spirit of the modern woman war correspondent. And Jackie actually right now is teaching at Columbia College in Chicago. So I have to sort of, since I have the opportunity, I have to make sure that I recognize her contribution to the book and also certainly her career.
John, we have about a minute or so left. I don't want to give away the end of the book. I think people know, if they know her, they know the history of what happened and how she eventually died in action. Do you want to tell us that, or should we save that for the book?
Well, you know what? I think that what I always keep in mind is the fact that what I'm doing is looking at somebody who there's no doubt that she did die in action. And there is a very dramatic photo that's an iconic photo of World War II, I'm sorry, of Vietnam that she was an unfortunate party to on the day that she died. So from that standpoint, there's no way to get around that aspect of the book. But the one thing that I want to always reinforce is that it's not necessarily a story about her death. It's a story about her life and her work. And I think that's really the most significant thing to keep in mind.
And that she lives on today in the pages of this book.
Yes, absolutely.
John Garofolo, thanks for being with us today. The author of Dickie Chappelle Under Fire, photographs by the first American female war correspondent killed in action. John, thanks again. And again, thank you for your service.
Hey, thanks a lot, Steve. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 5:39 now on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. Glad to have you along. The 2017 Edelman Trust Barometer is out, and it shows that our trust in all four key institutions, business, government, NGOs, the media, has declined broadly. It is a report that Edelman has began doing in 2012, since 2012, and the new numbers are out. Truth is in crisis is the headline. Harlan Loeb is with Edelman, and he is with us this morning from San Francisco. Harlan, first of all, thank you very much for getting up so early. I know it is a quick early start to your day.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So the headline is very concerning, trust in crisis, not just here in the United States, but around the world. Tell us how bad it is.
We've had unprecedentedly low trust levels in media, in government, in non-governmental organizations, and of course, in business. And when you create an environment of mortgage trust at that level, you see the results, both political and business distrust across the globe. You see reflexive protectionism and populism taking hold in a variety of different countries at the same time, which you've not seen in my lifetime.
And, you know, on a very basic level, it's we just don't think that the system works for us. Is that a good way to describe it?
I think that's spot on, Steve. People are either fearful or very concerned that the system is just not functioning, and that includes people of all stations in life, whether you have, you know, middle income, high income, all of the, I think that's been income agnostic. The data is a little different based on income, but fundamentally the conclusion is the same.
This speaks to volumes to the political climate, not only here, but around the world, does it not?
It does. And our trust barometer began actually in 2000. So we have considerable data. And over the last 5 years, actually 2012, as you noted, we began to see this fissure in critical institutions, trust in critical institutions begin to take hold. So this isn't a sudden consequence. This has been building for quite some time. All these organizations, in effect, were on notice, and the gap between the populace and these institutions has widened significantly over the last 3 years.
What can you tell us about what information they might have had to maybe start moving in the other direction, and why aren't they listening?
A number of things. As you saw, I think it happened quickly, but not obviously. So as the digital age transformed the way in which we consume information, and at the same time, you saw major crises of all the institutions we've talked about, you know, from the age of Enron through the financial crisis up through the 2010 crises with BP and Toyota and that. And the ability to communicate globally, trading opinion as fact, all of that kind of coalesced into what I would say a global cloud of distrust. And institutions, particularly among millennials, and institutions that had served them well and they trusted to be experts on the topics that they covered, governments, you know, being fundamentally competent to govern, and media institutions fundamentally competent to provide the facts and so forth, let them down, let all of these people down, and distrust has been the outcome. And like any other fear-based outcome, the instinct is to circle the wagons and protect.
The survey, we might say, it's conducted in 28 countries, and I know people have had a lot of distrust in polls and surveys lately too, but the methodology of this survey is one where you make sure you get people who are in the know, who have knowledge of events. How much of an impact does that have on this survey, knowing that these are well-educated, well-informed people?
Well, there's two different. We do the general public, and then we segregate some of it between what we call informed publics, meaning college-educated news consumers, people that are listening to your show, for example, at 5:30 a.m. And among both, there's growing distrust. The gap between the informed publics and the general population is a bit disturbing in double-digit figures. But it tells us that those that are consuming information are consuming it differently, and they are cynical as to what the information means. And in this kind of post-truth environment, as they're calling it, or post-fact environment, it makes the advent of our new administration all the more frightening, because it exists obviously in this new operating context, which has everybody on edge, as you well know.
So with this all as the background, the question then becomes what we have seen in the last 24 hours, and that is in corporate boardrooms, CEOs publicly and privately now coming out saying how they feel about the immigration orders, the refugee ban. Does this go to a building trust? I mean, I can't imagine the nightmare scenarios that must be unfolding in these boardrooms as they decide, A, do I battle the president or stand up for what I think is right?
It's a great question, and I don't think it's an either or. I think it's critical to step back and look at the operating context in which this is happening. And if anyone's looked at The Art of the Deal, which is the president's book, his negotiation style is unlike any other president in our history. Truthful hyperbole is, I think, what he calls it. So his negotiation style is to come out very, very aggressively, kind of smack you in the mouth. With an edict. We saw it with his tweets. We're now seeing it with executive orders. And I think companies would be wise to think more in responsive terms than reactive terms, and consider that this is not likely to net out where it's the opening salvo for the most massive negotiation I think this country has ever had, and that you can double down on your base, reassuring employees that the values that you stand for. If you're a company like Starbucks or Apple, and you have a history of speaking out on social issues, then you should stick to your competencies. For other companies that have never ventured into these spaces, it may be a time to double down with employees to assure them that you're looking out for their interests and that you're fully engaged in the issue. But at the same time, recognizing that as a business, it very well may wind up at the end of the day at a different place than it is currently.
Is a way to think about this is presidents come and go. Your company is going to be here for a long time.
I think if you look at it, and we're all somewhat naturally reactive. This is a very unnatural environment, and thus instinct kicks in. But when you take kind of that critical exhale. Business is going to be here for a long time. I do think you're going to see an alliance of business and a reorganization of strategic relationships between business and certain NGOs. You're already seeing it with the ACLU. So I do think you're going to see reconfiguration between in a kind of a private regulatory context when business is working with other enterprises and groups like, as I said, ACLU or other kinds of groups like that, academics, to strategize. I think that's how businesses will begin to negotiate this environment, and that'll be strength in numbers and common cause. And you have seen it actually in the last 24 hours with the ban. You're seeing some. Not only tech companies come out, but recently, last night, even Ford, Goldman Sachs, GE come out and speak on this issue. And I think that there is a strength in numbers, and the negotiation that has been initiated is not as unilateral as it may have been for Mr. Trump in his private career.
We should say, for people who may not know the lingo, NGO is a non-governmental organization, usually like a nonprofit. So, Harlan, I have to ask you this. What would your advice be if you were advising the public on how to believe, and also some of these institutions on how to gain trust?
How to believe is that, thankfully, in this country, we have checks and balances that are well in place. For the Justice Department, for example, despite the firing last night, has to vet these executive orders. There are checks and balances in our system, thankfully, unique to our constitutional democracy, that afford us protections that is a check on the presidency. And so as you look at this, I think it's a playbook that the administration and Mr. Trump in particular is using. And now is a time to, now if you were looking at this as a deal, now is the due diligence time, because ultimately he'll run his place. He will become much more predictable in terms of what he's trying to do. And companies can be far more strategic if they take this time to engage, double down on their base, and study what it is that he's doing. And on the basis of that, I think, in, you know, when we talk maybe 6 months from now or a year from now, I think it's an opportunity for companies to build trust within their organizations. Again, double down on employee communications, your most important asset. Build new bridges that perhaps didn't exist before. And I think business can come out of it much stronger than it is right now. I think this is an opportunity as much as anything else.
Yeah, and the challenge ahead of us, I think, could be summed up with the two words, alternative facts,
yes,
going forward.
Facts have been negotiable since the dawn of time, but now we have a global trading floor for it called social media, and a administration that believes in truthful hyperbole. So news people like you have a real responsibility to inform your publics.
Well, Harlan Loeb of Edelman Public Relations, we look forward to having you on in maybe 6 months or a year and see how this thing's shaping up.
Would welcome the opportunity and appreciate the moment to speak with you.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, as we head toward the opening bell at 8:30 Chicago time today, Dow Jones futures off 24, NASDAQ futures off about 8, S&P futures down about 3. For commodities and agriculture now, good morning, Ori and Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. And let's begin this day by saying good morning to a lot of great WGN listeners in Western Illinois. Last night, traveled to Carthage, Illinois, to speak for the First State Bank of Illinois, their 30th Ag Strategy Outlook meeting, and a good turnout of about 280 people for the event last night. And we had a good time and a lot of great listeners out there, so a good morning to them. Well, not only did the stock market take a tumble yesterday, but live cattle futures fell the most in 3 weeks, thanks to that cattle on feed report on Friday afternoon that showed a pretty good increase in the number of cattle placed on feed in the month of December. One analyst said the placements we saw last week were very, very large, and it's a pretty negative number. March feeder cattle were down $3.55 a hundredweight, and February live cattle finished the day down $2.15. Now, in the grain market, not quite as volatile. As a matter of fact, in our overnight trade now, we're looking at March wheat up about 1.25 cents a bushel, March corn up 1.25, March soybeans up 2 cents. In a fairly quiet overnight trade. You all have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a great day as well. And now the Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Tuesday, January 31st. Among the economic reports due out today, Standard & Poor's releases the S&P Case-Shiller Index of Home Prices. The Conference Board will also report on consumer confidence for January. Investors will be closely watching as the Federal Reserve begins meeting today. It's a two-day meeting. Policymakers will gather to set interest rates. We do not expect a change in the rate, but they will certainly have discussions about it coming in the later part of this year. Earnings reports due today from Aetna, Pfizer, United Parcel Service, ExxonMobil Corporation, and Apple Incorporated. We also will see MasterCard, Under Armour, Sprint, and UPS. Also, the Fed will wrap up its meeting tomorrow. Again, we do not expect a news conference or any policy change in terms of interest rates after the Fed meeting, the two-day meeting. We expect those interest rates, again, to come later this year.